You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Joining us now, Gary Aldridge. Gary is a former FBI agent and author of Unlimited Access, an FBI agent inside the Clinton White House. We keep talking in light of this shooting in Florida. We keep talking and keep saying, we have to do something. We have to do something. What would you, as a former FBI agent, suggest we do to stop these shootings?
Well, right now I'm focused on the school because I'm reading this morning, if it's true, I'm reading this morning that one of the reasons he was put on suspension by the school was he was caught carrying bullets into the school, and this is after he has already established a reputation for being a very strange young man with students and teachers complaining about him. I'm wondering what in the world were they thinking when they caught him with the bullets? What did they do besides suspend him?
Right. Yeah. And meanwhile, it does start at the school level. Meanwhile, from the FBI level, we now know that he, posting under his real name, Nicholas Cruz, under a YouTube video last year, said I'm going to be a professional school shooter. That led the creator of that YouTube video to contact the FBI, who by extension did an interview with him. But that's where it appears to have stopped. What do you make of the FBI's involvement in this? Do you, in your assessment, did things go the right way, or were mistakes made by these investigators?
I've explored the explanation by the FBI officials very closely because I was thinking myself, what would I do? And the next thing that I would be able to do with respect to YouTube is probably make the usual request, whereupon their lawyers would push back on it and say no, and then we'd have to go to court and get some sort of legal help through the courts to force YouTube to give up the information, the identity of the person who posted the sentence that was seen in the YouTube. So when you look at it, it sounds simple at first, but when you start digging into it, you realize that if the agencies, all of the agencies, had to take every single allegation and take it out to the next logical step, the social media has pushed back very, very strongly on allowing law enforcement to know who the posters of these pictures and statements and crazy things are.
Yeah.
Who they are and where they are and, you know, and find out more information.
But meanwhile, of course, this should compel a serious review by the FBI to figure out whether or not its practices both meet civil liberties and the needs for communities that want to prevent the very tragedies we just saw. I want to ask you about something that you've been talking about, Gary, because you were an FBI agent during the Clinton administration.
Right.
And you've said that the Clinton White House retained a staffer who had domestic abuse allegations against him, despite the fact that we're seeing this week that the White House has had to fire Rob Porter and at least one other man, David Sorensen, last week over domestic abuse allegations against them.
Yes, this is true, and I believe that I posted that in the book that I wrote about the White House. It was one of the big reasons that I decided the American people had a right to know just how terrible the security was in the Clinton White House. He was just one of many, and this was just one allegation that stands out in view of the current circumstance with Rob Porter. But going back, just to be clear on this, I never saw media focus on the Clinton administration for all of the things they did that comes anywhere close to how they're focused on the Rob Porter allegations. I'm actually amazed at how alert the media is to every little thing that happens at the Trump White House, and I don't think consider a spousal a physical abuse to be a small thing. Don't get me wrong.
Yes,
but it may be that during the early months of the White House administration forming, they didn't have a strict security policy in place, because I think sometimes White House administrations have to go through a few of these things to understand why it's so important, maybe to deny a favorite candidate a position, you know, because the long-term implications are so amazingly impacting to the administration.
What would you suggest? What would your advice be to this White House in order to tighten these things up so that they don't have more incidents like this and they run more like the Clinton White House?
You know, I really apologize. Your voice is so hard for me to hear.
That's all right.
Through this connection. Could you repeat the question?
She was just asking what could they do to become more like the Clinton White House in terms of just, you know, being able to conduct their business.
Oh, I would never recommend that the Trump administration become like the Clinton administration.
There you go. Well, it would start with the media liking you, I would guess.
I would go back to the Bush administration, which was my foundation was seeing how the Bush administration did it, and then the Clinton administration came in and it was horrible. So based on what I saw in the Bush administration,
yes.
I would suggest that they find some former Bush administration folks who had worked in this area of expertise and maybe talk to them.
Can I go back to the Clinton staffer allegation? Because I think it's a really important one.
Mm-hmm.
I know you haven't identified the person in public, but Rob Porter is being framed as a very high-level staffer here, as somebody who handled all the paperwork inside the White House, and that the White House should have known about this domestic abuse allegation because he was at risk of being blackmailed as a result of it being out there. How high-level is the person in the Clinton White House that you're talking about?
Well, he wasn't a staffer. Put it that way, he wasn't a staffer, but he was in Al Gore's office, the vice president's office. But the vice president's office has the same security procedures and policies that are run out of the White House counsel's office, as does the president's office. So it's not like the vice president had a different system. He did not. And so it was pretty serious, it was many, many allegations of lots and lots of things wrong with this guy.
How dire were the allegations? Like what?
Well, I mean, when you put your wife in the hospital, I think that's pretty dire.
Yeah, big time. So you're saying this person is not a staffer, yet worked for the vice president? How does that work?
No, there's staffers and then there's management. I consider a staffer to be somebody who's middle range position in the White House. The media is trying to make this Rob Porter out to be, cabinet level. That's the way it's being painted.
Yes.
But he looks like a very young man who's, I don't know how old he is actually, but he looks like a younger man who may have achieved the highest administrative post that he's had yet in his careers. So to say that he wasn't, there were a lot of people working around the Oval Office when I worked at the White House.
Right.
And they were considered staffers. That means they weren't in the top tier of decision makers or policy makers.
Amazing. I mean, if there's one thing you've illuminated, it's yet again that there's a tremendous double standard when
double
it comes
standard.
To
Absolutely.
The political parties involved here. Thank you, Gary Aldridge. Really appreciate your insight this morning as a former FBI agent and author of Unlimited Access, an FBI agent inside the Clinton White House. Gary, thank you.
Appreciate you having me on.
Sure thing.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Let's talk immigration. We got Mark Krikorian joining us from the Center for Immigration Studies. Mark, good morning. A busy week for the immigration debate, sir.
Yeah, good morning. It's supposed to be busier. They haven't even really started the debate.
That's right.
Democrats have been obstructing things.
Yeah, what's going on there? It was a sanctuary city measure that the Republicans were looking to get started on. This after Mitch McConnell had promised to have this open debate, and they're like, let's do it. And some Republicans start saying, okay, let's talk sanctuary cities, and Democrats bring the whole thing to a screeching halt.
Right. That was supposed to be the First Amendment was that they were going to take up, because what Senator McConnell did is he took a bill the House had sent over, stripped all the language of it out, it wasn't an immigration bill, and used it as kind of a shell, an empty shell, and said, look, we're supposed to be the world's greatest deliberative body. Let's start deliberating. We'll have a debate. Anybody can introduce. Republicans and Democrats will alternate in, submitting amendments. And, you know, we'll see what people want to do. We'll see what can get 60 votes. And Senator Schumer, the literally the first thing they were going to take up, this amendment from Senator Toomey to address sanctuary cities, which, after all, is one of the things that pulls illegal immigrants across the border in the first place. So it is germane. Senator Schumer said, no, we're not going to do that. And so it's Wednesday now in the week that they were supposed to be, you know, this was supposed to be immigration week. It's Wednesday, and they haven't had a single vote on a single amendment yet.
Yeah, and this is I was saying to Vince before when we were discussing this is what they're supposed to do. It is so refreshing to actually see Congress debating ideas and trying to whittle it down and working as, I don't know, a group in order to come out with what's best for the American people. And I can't remember the last time that this has actually been done, when we've had this kind of open, almost a brainstorming session in Congress. Do you know the last time we did this? Because we couldn't think of the last time this was ever done. And I love this.
Yeah, no, I can't either. And the problem is that it's not happening. I mean, I had joked that, well, I don't know if it was really a joke. I said, look, maybe this week would show that calling the Senate the world's greatest deliberative body isn't just a sarcastic joke. The problem is, it does seem to just be a sarcastic joke, because, like I said, it's now Wednesday and they haven't done anything yet, and next week they're not even around. They're back home working.
So what do the Democrats get out of being obstructionists with this? Because I guess they're just going to keep taking this through the courts, because we have a judge now who said you got to keep DACA going. You even have to accept new ones. And they're just going to keep getting more and more people into the system until it goes to the Supremes. Is that what their game is?
Well, I think so, although I think the Supreme Court is going to slap down. This was the second ruling saying that the president isn't allowed to end this illegal program, which wasn't a law, which wasn't an executive order. It was just a memo, literally just a memo in Homeland Security. And now there's two judges, basically, you know, judges in the resistance, who are basically saying it doesn't matter what the law says. Trump's doing it, so we're going to do whatever we can to try to stop it. If we get slapped down later, that's okay, but we're going to obstruct as long as possible.
The rationale by which these judges have done this seems bizarre. They're contesting the notion that the Trump administration has called DACA unconstitutional. And they're saying, well, that's just not true, so therefore DACA has to be maintained. Who cares what the rationale is for why the president's getting rid of it? Whether or not you think it's unconstitutional, it's well within his rights to control immigration policy, particularly immigration policy that was invented in the executive.
Right, exactly. I mean, look, if the president said, look, I didn't like the color of the pen that this memo was signed on by the Homeland Security Secretary in the previous administration, that's perfectly enough rationale to get rid of that policy. This is an area where the president has complete authority. And, you know, this really is a disturbing trend where our judiciary is increasingly unconnected to the law. They are simply making stuff up. And, you know, this has been a trend for a while now, but because with President Trump, we now have judges basically saying, obviously, what is before us is legal, but because Trump did it, we're just not going to let him do it anyway.
So because this judge has now said not only does DACA have to continue, but they have to start processing new applications now as well. So where does this leave the administration as far as DACA? This just, complicates the problem, because now you've got more people coming into DACA, and now they're going to start getting their extensions, so it puts it off for another, you know, 3 years or however long it takes.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason there was supposedly so much urgency in the Senate and the House to do something about it was that the president, 6 months, well, 5 months ago now, canceled the program. He was supposed to have done it on day one last January, but put it off till day 200. But he said, look, I'm canceling this, but I'm given a six-month grace period because this is something Congress should do. And there's a lot of these people, they have work permits, so, you know, come up with a solution. That was March 5th is supposed to be the deadline. But because of these rulings, March 5th isn't the deadline. Well, if there's no deadline, then there's not that much urgency for Congress really to do anything about it.
No,
so it's entirely possible this week will end, and that empty shell of a bill that I mentioned that the immigration stuff was supposed to be in might still be empty.
Right. So let's read the political tea leaves on this. Do Democrats even want an amnesty to pass before the election?
I think the way I think about it is that they would be happy to get a deal for the DACAs as long as they didn't have to give anything in exchange. If they didn't have to give anything up, which is basically what the proposal, the one in the Senate that the Democrats are supporting, that is from Senator McCain, unsurprisingly, they'd be happy to get that. But Plan B is, yes, is to make this a political issue, though I'm not sure that's really going to work for them, because remember when they did the government shutdown over the amnesty, they said we're not going to agree to funding the government because there's no amnesty in the bill. They caved in a couple of days because their polling showed this was a disaster for them, even though, or let me put it this way, even among people who are sympathetic to the DACAs. Well, I am, but the idea of shutting the government down over an amnesty for illegal immigrants was not playing well, and they immediately caved. I don't think it's going to work for them that much politically if that's their plan.
Interesting. It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, and I'm anxious to see once this goes to the Supremes, which it probably will, and they'll probably fast track it, the president's reaction once it's overturned and he's given back the authority. I would like to see, I'm curious to see how he handles that and the speed with which he says, "All right, enough is enough." Mark, thank you so much for breaking it down for us. Really appreciate it because it's craziness there.
Thank you.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. The best of Mornings on the Mall.
Right now is Dr. Sebastian Gorka, Fox News national security strategist, New York Times best-selling author of Defeat Jihad, and former deputy assistant to President Donald Trump. Dr. Gorka, good morning. Welcome back to Mornings on the Mall.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Let's talk about Rob Porter. We've got Trey Gowdy yesterday announcing a House Oversight Committee probe into this entire incident. Can you explain to us what exactly they are investigating? Was there a crime committed? What's the problem here?
I can't really. You'd have to ask him. The issue here is, I think clearly for some people, the question of the timeline. So, you know, who knew what about Rob Porter when? But as I wrote yesterday in The Hill, there's a much larger issue here, and hopefully Trey Gowdy is going to look at that. And that's the question of who controls the whole security clearance process for those that are working in the White House. And is it potentially being exploited by holdovers, people from the last administration, to subtly subvert the work of the new administration? Because in my experience, I saw people very highly qualified people who were loyal to the president, offered positions in the National Security Council, whose clearances were slow-rolled by the CIA. The SCI portion of their clearance was slow-rolled. I saw a detailee from the DOD who had his clearance suspended by his former boss simply because he didn't like the fact that he was working for the Trump administration. And I saw, you know, various things that indicate to me the system is broken, and given the last 8 years of highly politicized activity at the FBI, DOJ, and even the CIA, we have a real potential problem here.
Are you saying that there have been a range of Trump officials that have been held to interim security clearances because of political actors who are keeping them in that status?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I can even, you know, there's also the issue of just staffing the White House. As I wrote in my piece at the beginning of, you know, just after we came in, I requested three individuals by name from the FBI to come and work for me at the White House. These are people who I taught in the past. I knew them personally. The FBI slow rolled that for 6 months, which is unheard of. The idea that the White House wants people to come over, that should be an HR function that takes about 2 weeks. And at the end of the day, I had a senior agent of the FBI tell me you need to understand, and this is a direct quote, the seventh floor of the Hoover building looks at the Trump White House as, quote-unquote, the enemy. That's the problem, because the FBI works for the president, as does the whole intelligence community.
Well, that's clearly very troubling, and I've heard you tell that anecdote before, and one would shudder to think that that's real. When you talk about this, you know, the White House in the past week has said that the security clearance for Rob Porter got bottlenecked in a place called the White House Personnel Security Office, the FBI, claiming, Christopher Wray claiming that they had made determinations about his security clearance that were reported back to the White House last year on at least two occasions. So what is the Personnel Security Office's role in all of this, where the White House has claimed they have career people there?
Right. So the way it works, and I give the thumbnail in the Hill piece, is an individual fills out their SF-86, which is this form about their history, their employment history, their family, any foreigners they're in contact with. Then that gets handed over to OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, and then the FBI gets involved. Contract investigators do interviews of their neighbors, their ex-wife, what have you. And then finally, and this can take more than a year, that report, that determination of whether that person is vulnerable or is a threat to national security, comes back to the White House if they're supposed to get a special compartmented information clearance as well. The CIA does that portion of it, goes back to this personnel security, the security office for personnel at the White House. They look at that package. They don't have the capacity to do interviews the way the FBI does. They make a recommendation to the chief of staff, and at that point, the final decision is made as to whether the person gets the clearance. But that office is a tiny office. I mean, in comparison to the CIA and the FBI, it's a fraction of the personnel. So really, it's a rubber stamping effort.
So isn't this, though, where John Kelly can come in and say, look, we've got to move on these things faster? Does he have any pull to expedite these clearances if he thinks they're being slow-rolled?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is the problem. In the last decade, we've seen a mushrooming. Almost a million people have clearances in America, which is just insane. There has to be a prioritization. The idea that you've got a few dozen people in the White House at the top of the United States national security structure, and in many cases, these people are waiting for more than a year to get from interim to permanent is insane. And to find out that people are held hostage by agencies who potentially don't like them. I know an individual was offered one of the directorships at the NSC, immensely qualified individual. The individuals of the CIA didn't like him, and so they just refused to expedite his clearance, and as such, he had to rescind, he had to refuse the office. So, yes, the chief of staff works for the president. He's the senior-ranking person you can imagine in the U.S. government, so in theory, he could say, I want these yesterday, make it happen. And, you know, the conclusion of my article is the president of the United States needs to reassert control over this whole process, because guess what? The intelligence agencies don't work for themselves. Their purpose for existing is to inform the decision-making capacity of the president in the interests of the United States. So, you know, he's the boss.
What do you make of all of these, like, former and supposedly current White House officials leaking, and not just leaking, but Anthony Scaramucci and Corey Lewandowski have both laid blame at the feet of John Kelly, and in the former's case, Anthony Scaramucci, he's calling on him to resign. Are you on board with that?
Not at all. I we could spend some time about the disgusting things Omarosa's done. Corey never worked for the administration. How long was Anthony in the building? What was it, 6 days? My interactions with Chief of Staff Kelly reaffirmed everything that is known about him. He's a legend in the Marine Corps. He is an incredibly decisive, efficient individual, as you'd expect of a four-star Marine Corps general. So, no, Anthony doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm sorry. He doesn't know what went on inside the building, so he should keep his opinions to himself.
Yeah, and I think it's very hard when you have these people who maybe were scorned or felt that they should have been part of the administration and for whatever reason were let go. They have a very public forum because the media wants to hear them trash the president. So the microphone is always in front of their face and it makes them suddenly important and it feeds that entire thing. Dr. Gorka, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it so much and have a wonderful weekend.
I'll see you guys in CPAC.
See you then.
That's right. See you then.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Mary Welter. I'm here with Vince Colonnese.
You know, on Tuesday mornings, I always think to myself, you know who I want to speak to? Somebody who has former Secret Service experience and also is the author of the book Protecting the President and host of the Dan Bongino Show. And it just so happens we have somebody who fits that description. Dan Bongino joins us now. Dan, good morning, sir.
Hey, good to talk to you all.
Nice to talk to you again. Now that we have you, I want to talk about Secret Service stuff for just a second because I was so fascinated. Forget the media's insane reaction to the fact that Kim Jong-un's sister was in the box with Mike Pence. The actual security dance that goes into having the Vice President of the United States sitting alongside a brutal dictator's sister, who, by the way, is involved in a family that's already executed other members of their own family. How does that work for the Secret Service exactly?
Well, this is a tough one because I don't want to give anything away, but obviously when you're dealing with diplomats or diplomatic representatives from a country, there are certain courtesies that are extended that aren't extended to other people that are in that inner circle, what we call like arm's reach,
right,
of the protectee. So there's not much you can do. I mean, if you think the, let's say some Russian diplomat is going to, you know, shank the president of the United States in a meeting, then it's all for naught. I mean, there's nothing you can really do about it. It's complicated to talk about because I don't really want to give away what happens in the inner circle, but it's a different level of security. And it's done differently because we extend diplomatic courtesies, I guess, is where I'm going with that.
Well, you could talk about the stuff that's publicly seen, I mean, oftentimes, which is when you have members of, say, other governments and countries who have their own protective details. Like, so, say, she arrives with their own North Korean protection. Who takes preeminence? Does the Secret Service kind of always fight to be like, hey, we're in control of this entire atmosphere?
Well, yeah, well, they always do that, but you're also... You have to remember the Secret Service agents overseas, when you travel on these trips, you have no law enforcement powers at all. Zero. In the movies, you just whip out a badge and you're like, hey, I'm Secret Service. Everybody backs off and there's like this cloud of power, but that's not the way it works in the real world. In the real world, I mean, even diplomatic immunity is limited. You know, there's only so much you can do. So it's up to really the host country, how it's going to go down and how many people are going to be allowed in, the president has a certain cadre of guys and ladies around him all the time in the Secret Service, but they're not always allowed in. It really depends on the host country, and it really depends also on what the staff is willing to put up with in conjunction with the Secret Service. I mean, I always think back to that episode in Chile where, you know, they wouldn't let the special agent in charge in with President Bush, and it was President Bush who rescued the Secret Service, not the other way around. He grabbed Nick Trotta, the SAC, and brought him in the event with him.
Wow.
So it really depends on the host country. I know it sounds crazy, but it's not like it looks in the movies. You know, the host country and what they're willing to be permissive about really matters a lot.
Dan, I'd like to talk about something that you said yesterday on Fox and Friends. You were talking about the dossier, and you mentioned a name that we have not really heard connected to it, and that is former CIA Director John Brennan. What were you talking about with John Brennan? How is he connected to the dossier?
Yeah, John Brennan is the puppet master in this. I mean, he's pretending. This guy's unbelievable. You know, I can't recommend to anybody in the D.C. circle in strong enough terms that if you were involved in this, I mean it. I'm giving you advice as a former federal agent. I'm not kidding around. Stay off cable news. You are opening yourself up to such unbelievable liability. I don't know if it's out of hubris or not, but John Brennan, the timeline is so damning for John Brennan that he goes on cable news and pretends he has nothing to do with this. It's staggering. Remember, he's the one who meets with Harry Reid. in a kind of unprecedented meeting, the CIA director goes to meet with a member of the president's party up in the Senate, briefs him personally. In the next couple days, Harry Reid fires off a letter to the FBI with information that was only in the dossier. Where do you think he got that information from? Oh, and then, by the way, the FBI begins one of the most significant counterintelligence investigations in U.S. history. After that, this guy has serious liability here for engaging in this, and he's on cable news like he, you know, whistling past the graveyard. I mean, he's the one, I think, in this entire thing who understood he was limited in his intelligence capacity to investigate. He's not a law enforcement officer. So what did he do? He's the one who likely prods the FBI and Jim Comey to get involved. And that's why if you listen and you watch all his cable news hits, he's always throwing Jim Comey under the bus because he's a snake and he's trying to back himself out of this thing.
But in May of 2017, he was under oath, and you claim that when he was under oath, he denied knowing who commissioned the dossier. But if he previously, in August of 2016, so almost a year earlier, gave information to Harry Reid, then you're alleging that he had to have known who authored the dossier.
Not just that, Mary. How does the Central Intelligence Agency director, an agency with a lead responsibility role in the verification of foreign intelligence assets, which last time I checked, Christopher Steele's not a U.S. citizen, right? He's still a foreign intelligence asset. The fact that he's from a friendly country, the United Kingdom, makes no difference at all. He's still an intelligence asset. So the Central Intelligence Agency, by the way, and Christopher Steele, it's not his information. Steele's getting the information from Russian sources. For you to believe that the Central Intelligence Agency is not going to somehow get involved in authenticating the asset and some of the information coming from Russians is beyond disbelief.
Right.
I mean, the fact that Brennan claims they had nothing to do with this is just incredible. I can't believe it that he's still sticking to this story.
Right. They're surveilling people who are on the Trump campaign, but not Christopher Steele and the Russians he's speaking with. Kind of crazy stuff.
It's insane. It doesn't make any sense.
So Susan Rice, we got new reporting yesterday, thanks to Chuck Grassley, a letter that was released, saying that she memorialized a conversation that she allegedly had on January 5th in the Oval Office with the President of the United States. She waited until January 20th, that's inauguration day of last year, to declare that Obama was telling everyone in his circle to do the Russia investigation, quote, by the book. Why would she send an email like that in the waning minutes of that administration?
Well, I'm putting a book together on this, a literal book, and I've been slept more than like 6 hours a night for the last, say, month or so investigating this case. And one of the things I'm starting to put together is you see this pattern amongst all of these former Obama administration officials now, Jim Clapper, the ODNI, you see it in John Brennan. And now you're starting to see this pattern with Susan Rice when she did these media hits. This is why I can't say in strong enough terms to them, why are you going on cable news? Susan Rice has already been busted on cable news lying about the unmasked, lying, not misdirecting, not the fancy DC words, lying, telling you something that is not true. Why would she send that? Because Susan Rice was intimately involved in the unmasking of American citizens during record numbers of unmaskings in the last year of the Obama administration. And I'm telling you, the next shoe to drop in this thing is going to be the Obama email to Hillary Clinton. Remember, we know they exist. We just don't know what they say. And in those emails, God forbid, they talk about Perkins Coie and law firms that were paid by both Clinton, the Hillary Clinton team, and Obama's Organizing for America. I mean, you've got this scandal so big, I don't think the American public really has their arms around how devastating this is going to be to the liberal brand when it all comes out. You're police staters now. End the story.
Oh, Dan,
believe me, you're busted, and it's time to take a bath on it.
Dan Bongino, good luck with the rest of that book. Get some sleep eventually, but we'll be interested to talk to you, especially when that book comes out, sir.
Yeah, you got it.
Thanks, Mary.
Thanks, Dan.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
You hear about this movie, Black Panther?
How can you not hear about it?
Everyone's heard about it. It's the Marvel movie, a cool Marvel superhero. Finally in movie form, he's actually made an appearance in some of the prior movies. Captain America, Civil War, things like that. So now, audiences everywhere seem to be enjoying it, which is great. But at the same time, there's this weird sort of like social justice warrior thing going on with it at the same time. Which, you know, should not surprise you. I guess nowadays everything is a social justice crusade. But there's a woman by the name of Emily Lakdawala. Okay? Emily Lakdawala. Listen to this title. I need a title like this. Senior Editor and Planetary Evangelist. And she tweeted the following out about opening weekend for Black Panther. So I carefully did not buy Black Panther tickets for opening weekend because I did not want to be the white person sucking black joy out of the theater. What's the appropriate date for me to buy tickets? Is next weekend okay? She asks Twitter. She wants to know, at what point is it not racist for her to attend a movie that has a black lead in it?
I'm not saying I would feel this way, but I can see where we've gotten to that point in shaming white people for their quote unquote whiteness that she wouldn't go because someone's going to say something to her. She'd be like, you know what? I'm just not going.
And Ben Shapiro, we've had on this show, great Ben Shapiro, responds, you must never go out in public again. That is the only way to ensure that others will not be offended by your presence. It sounds like it's pretty good. I'm not going to ask anybody for permission.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live on 105.9 FM WMAL.